It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up later in the show, we'll talk with two scientists about an upcoming effort to develop new classes of antibiotics that could fight everything from infection to cancer.
First, President Obama announced today he's seeking higher fuel standards for heavy-duty vehicles such as big rig trucks. The White House says these trucks amount to just 4% of registered vehicles on U.S. roads, but they account for 20% of on-road energy use and carbon emissions.
The president is issuing the orders directly to the EPA and the Transportation Department, as opposed to taking the matter to Congress. It's the latest action the president has taken in recent weeks in an overall plan to tackle climate change.
Here to talk with us about the new standards is Alex Guillen. He's an energy reporter at Politico. Alex, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about these standards so far?
Well, the standards that they're going to write, the news that came out today deals with vehicle model years after 2018. So we're looking at things that are, you know, we're not going to be seeing these models for quite some time. But obviously they have to start working on that now in order for the standards to be written and finalized before design begins. Mm-hmm. So the extent of these standards, obviously at this point, are unclear. Just to give you a sense of the timeline, the president directed EPA and the Transportation Department to finish the proposal by March of 2015, so a bit more than a year from now, and then to finalize the rule a year after that, March of 2016.
And the president is also talking about heavy-duty vehicles here. What sorts of vehicles fall into this category?
It's a pretty wide variety, which also accounts for a lot of difficulty in writing standards for these. You have to consider a large variety of vehicles. But it's everything from school buses and garbage trucks to the fuel tankers and the 18-wheelers that you see on the highways all the time. Mm-hmm. They make up a relatively small percentage of the road traffic, even though for those of us who drive on the interstate, sometimes it doesn't always feel that way. But they have obviously enormous engines, and they make up a large percentage of the greenhouse gas emissions that come out of the transportation industry.
Right, and when I see those big rigs and those buses heading down the highway, I don't necessarily see new ones, or if they're new, I can't tell. So what's the turnover rate on these vehicles? How soon would we see a diminishing effect of the greenhouse gas emissions after 2018?
Well, that's difficult to say. You know, these trucks remain in service for quite some time, many years, decades even. But since you can't really go back and cut down emissions on already built vehicles, you know, you can really only look to the future. So how quickly we'll start seeing a drop-off in greenhouse gas emissions is unclear. It would obviously start in 2018 for these rules. And I should mention, of course, that in 2011, the administration finalized new rules for these vehicles that apply to model years 2014 to 2018. So we're really just starting to see those vehicles come on the market.
The EPA and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has to work with manufacturers, states, labor groups, and others, you write, and in order to work on this issue. That's a lot of buy-in to try to get here. How can they do it?
It definitely sounds like there's a lot of people involved in this, and there are, to be sure. But I think it's important to remember that the administration has done this before on two separate occasions, really. I just mentioned a minute ago the standards they put out a few years ago for the 2014 through 2018 models of heavy-duty trucks. Those actually have been fairly popular, and the American Trucking Association was heavily involved in that, and they supported those standards coming out. So, you know, there's not always a lot of antagonism here. Now, today, the American Trucking Association said they're a little bit more wary about these 2018 standards, but of course that process is really only just beginning. So I think as the trucking industry meets with the administration and they start looking at things that they can do post-2018, we'll get a better sense of what these standards might be and how the industry will adapt to them. And then the other instance I mentioned is the administration also, in Obama's first term, finalized standards, new fuel economy standards for passenger vehicles, which a lot of people have heard about, that the goal is to get the average standard up to 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. That was another instance where there was obviously a lot of coordination with the states, with the labor groups, with the industry, with environmental groups, that it all worked out fairly well in the end from most people's viewpoint.
So what resources will be made available to help this along?
Oh, what do you mean?
Oh, like financial resources to help the manufacturers and the states and others to start implementing some of these changes.
Right. Well, that's not something that's very clear at the moment. A lot of it does come through the industry. We'll pay for a lot of it. And so the point is, it's true that in general you're paying more for this the advanced technology and the new models. But the idea is that you're paying some more up front, but you save a lot more over time as your fuel use is cut down significantly. And so not only the idea is not only are you saving money on fuel costs, and obviously the trucking industry has lots of fuel costs, but you're also cutting down on the use of oil. The White House likes to point out that this could help cut U.S. oil imports. And it also, of course, cuts down on greenhouse gas emissions. The transportation sector is the number two source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And the heavy truck industry is the number two source within the transportation industry.
Well, this isn't the first time the president has pursued tightened fuel standards. What else has he done during his tenure so far, both for heavy vehicles and the regular cars and trucks that we drive every day?
Definitely. The overall car standards that I said earlier, the idea is to get those done by 2025, or to have that average up to that 2025. The heavy trucking industry, like I said, we've already started to see some of these newer models on the market, and we'll see that coming online more and more in the coming years. And then, of course, right now they're working on the post-2018 rule.
Some are wondering why the president isn't taking this to Congress. Why is he taking this route of going straight to the EPA?
We've known that this particular move is coming for some time. Obviously, after they finalized the first round of heavy trucking rules that cover 2014 to 2018, the obvious next step is to cover post-2018. And also last year in June, the president laid out his big climate agenda. And this particular move was on that. He had a rather long list there of items. So why isn't he going to Congress? This isn't something he needs Congress for. It also helps highlight the whole theme, as he talked about in the State of the Union, of taking executive action where he can and working with Congress otherwise. So the administration already has basically the authority to work on this. So that's why he's directing EPA and the Transportation Department to take action now.
Is there a concern that the added cost of developing new and more efficient vehicles would actually mean higher costs for things like trucking?
That's always a criticism that comes up. Like I mentioned, the trucking industry was on board with the previous standards, and we'll see what happens with these new ones. Obviously, there's no idea yet what exactly those are going to require. So the increased cost is always a concern, but the idea is that you save money over time on fuel standards, and theoretically, that does help reduce the cost. A lot of freight in the U.S., the majority, is moved via these heavy trucks. So the idea is potentially it helps to cut down on the price of everything from milk to anything else you might buy.
Well, what other efforts might we expect from President Obama in the remainder of his tenure here in the way of dealing with climate change?
The biggest thing the administration is working on right now would probably be the emission standards for power plants. They've already proposed new standards for future power plants. The EPA right now is working on writing a proposed rule for emissions from current power plants. So those are probably the number one thing the administration is doing on climate change right now. The electric generation industry is the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States before the transportation industry. So he's working on that. There's a very wide variety of actions the administration is taking. Dealing with international efforts, with UN climate talks. There's a major conference coming up next year. And just this last Friday, the administration and the president made a point of going to California to discuss the drought that's happening there, the possible connections, to climate change coming out of that drought and other extreme weather events. So we're seeing a lot of focus on the administration on both climate change and helping to stop that and on adapting to what's already starting to happen to the climate.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Alex Guillen is an energy reporter at Politico. We've been talking with him about the new fuel standards for heavy-duty vehicles as laid out by President Obama today. According to some scientists, we may be entering a post-antibiotics era as resistant bacteria outrace our development of new drugs.
But a team of scientists is trying to turn that scenario around and bring about a new crop of medical miracles by mining the deep oceans for undiscovered organisms that could become new classes of antibiotics that could fight everything from infection to cancer. Joining us now to talk about that effort, we have Marcel Jaspers, professor of organic chemistry at Aberdeen University in Scotland and leader of the Pharmacy Project, and John White, who wrote about the story in New Scientist magazine. Marcel, thank you so much for joining us. We have Marcel?
Yes.
And I'm hearing someone. Marcel, is that you? Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank
Excellent.
You.
And we have John White. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Welcome to you as well. And Marcel, I want to start with you. Tell us, what is the Pharmacy Project?
It's a very large European project in which we try to go all the way from the beginning, from getting new bacteria from the deep sea and cold environments, and then turning them into interesting new antibiotics and treatments for other diseases, such as diseases of the central nervous system.
Now, you're looking in an extreme area of the world. We're talking about way below the ocean surface, an area that hasn't really been trawled that much for things like this, for organisms. What's unusual about what you're doing?
Well, really, it's thinking about where the next generation of drugs is going to come from. And in the past, people have looked at very remote environments, such as Easter Island, and found amazing new drugs there. So what we're thinking is that ocean trenches, which cover about 1% of the Earth and are deeper than 6,000 meters, so that's about 4 miles deep, and these are essentially isolated environments where life has evolved slightly differently. And by looking there, we think we can find bacteria that produce new drugs or new molecules that we can turn into drugs.
And John, set the stage for us, if you would. Why do we need to turn to such extreme efforts, such extreme places on the planet, like this deep sea sampling for antibiotics?
Sure. Well, I think both in the US and the UK, health officials have been sort of sounding alarm bells about antibiotic resistance in a range of infections for some time. And those alarm bells have only got louder in recent years. And the worry is that eventually infections that we can currently treat with drugs will develop resistance to all the drugs that we have to treat them. And it's a race against time to find a new class of drugs to put off this problem.
And there's a scientist that you quote in your article who says that in terms of new antibiotics in development, that the pipeline is pretty empty. Why is that?
Yes, correct. That's Laura Piddock, who is a microbiologist and who heads up a group called Antibiotic Action. So she is talking about the problem with persuading the pharmaceutical industry to pursue development of antibiotics, clearly getting any drug into use in humans is a very expensive process. And the problem with antibiotics is even if you do spend a lot of money to develop a new one, it will be used in a limited manner for the very reasons that we're talking about, i.e. if you overuse it, the infections you use it for will simply develop resistance to it. So, of course, the pharmaceutical companies can't really see a great sort of commercial benefit from developing these new drugs, so they've kind of dropped out of the race to an extent to develop these new medicines.
And you do say that about half of our drugs today come from organisms in the natural world. I wonder, could you just run through the list of some of the medicines that we use today and where they come from in nature?
Sure. I mean, ones that everybody have heard of things such as aspirin, of course, which comes from the bark of the willow tree. Others that you won't have heard of, one called vinblastine, which is a chemotherapy drug, which came from a plant found in Madagascar. And there'll be numerous others, of course. Most antibiotics will come from fungi or from bacteria that are found in nature. And this is, you know, as I wrote, at least half of our current medicines are either sourced from nature or inspired by chemicals refined in nature.
Okay, and so with that backdrop, Marcel, when does pharmacy get underway and begin this expedition?
So we started the project about 18 months ago using strains that we had in-house from similar locations. So we have bacteria, say, from Antarctica, from deep oceans already, that we started on, but the new collections will start this summer. So we have an expedition plan to the Atacama Trench off Chile, which is about 8,000 meters deep, so it's about 5 miles deep. And it's a unique environment. It's close to shore. It's very deep, quite cold. Of course, very high pressure down there. And as far as we know, it has a very high organic matter content. So that means that we expect to see quite a rich microbial life down there. And again, we don't know what kind of bacteria we're going to find, but we hope that they will be new. And the sort of evidence from other places in the world has shown that bacteria from the very deep environments can be very novel in terms of what they produce.
Now, as I understand it, one of the problems could be keeping these bacteria alive because they're used to a very specialized environment. They're used to extreme high pressure. How do you make sure they don't die on the way up or the way home?
So there's a couple of ways of thinking about it. I mean, some bacteria, so for instance, if I took a bacterium from the soil at the surface and put it under pressure, it would probably die. But there are strains I can get from deep ocean that are adapted to pressure in two different ways. One is to be able to survive only at high pressure, and there are others that like to can survive at all pressures up to a certain limit. And those are the ones we're targeting because we can grow those at normal pressures, we can grow them at high pressures, whereas the other ones that are specialized, they're just very deep, can only survive at those pressures, so that we have to bring those up under pressure. That's actually a very difficult business. So we're going to take samples up from the seafloor without maintaining the pressure, bring them up relatively slowly and make sure that the temperature doesn't increase too much, because actually the bigger difficulty is to keep the temperature just right, but it don't survive, but it don't shock from 2 or 3 degrees to 20 plus degrees at the surface of the water, so that they basically have a double shock. So we can, but what we've done in the past has shown that we can actually get bacteria to grow from sediments that we get from the very deep down oceans, and that they survive, and we can put them back under pressure, and then they start to produce new chemistry.
John, this is not the first time that extreme conditions have produced new drugs. What are some of the other places that people are starting to search?
Yeah, well, the part of what interested me about this whole story was that there are a range of extreme environments, not just the deep ocean trenches, that are being looked at, and that have been looked at. But we're talking about places like the extremely dry part of the Atacama Desert in Chile, you know, where it's so extreme that NASA uses that kind of area to simulate the surface of Mars. Hmm. So that's one place where they've been looking and where they've found a surprising variety of microbial life, which, although it's very early stages, they are sort of producing chemicals of interest, both possibly antibiotic and anti-inflammatory. I mean, the whole story about these kind of bacteria started out in Yellowstone National Park and the hot springs, which once again is another extreme environment. Very hot water, but once again, going back about 40 years, it was discovered that, you know, life was thriving there. And that, in fact, led to the discovery of a very important chemical called what is a polymerase, which is used to amplify very small samples of DNA, and effectively that kind of helped to usher in the genomic revolution that we all know about today. But other places, there are pit mines which have become lakes, where they find, you know, in extremely acidic water, fungi that are producing chemicals that help fight ovarian cancer. There are sea sponges that produce anti-cancer chemicals that have been discovered. And there is the cave in New Mexico where, once again, fungi have been found you know, living in sort of total darkness and pretty extreme environment. But once again, they're producing compounds that fight lung cancer cells.
And we have to leave it there, but it's fascinating stuff. And Marcel, I wish you good luck on your journey. And John, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We've been talking to Marcel Jaspers, professor of organic chemistry at Aberdeen University and leader of the Pharmacy Project, and John White, an opinion editor at New Scientist magazine, who wrote about that expedition.
Take a deep breath. Feels good, right? But did you ever stop to think about what you're inhaling? Oxygen is one of those things that we take for granted, but for a good chunk of Earth's history, the planet didn't actually have any oxygen at all.
That's according to our next guest, who's researching how Earth went from having no oxygen to becoming an oxygen-rich planet full of life. And in a new book, he fills us in on the history of the gas, what it tells us about the world around us, and what the future might hold for the planet's air.
Donald Canfield is a professor of ecology at the University of Southern Denmark and director of the Nordic Center for Earth Evolution. His new book is Oxygen, A 4 Billion Year History. Donald, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
You point out that oxygen is something that we all take for granted, but once we stop and think about it, how much can we learn about the world around us from oxygen?
Well, I like to think about it in a historical perspective. The whole world around us is basically driven by oxygen production and the utilization of oxygen. So I think if we want to understand the world as it is, oxygen is a central component of that understanding.
Why is that?
Well, if you think about it like this, 99% of the energy that is used and on this planet, actually, by a lot of biology on this planet, comes from the production of oxygen by plants. Well, the oxygen is a byproduct, but it comes from plant production. So basically, the food webs of the Earth are driven by oxygen production. We breathe oxygen. Dogs, cats, you know, all sorts of animals breathe oxygen. All sorts of microbes breathe oxygen. So it actually drives a good bit of the biology on the Earth. So oxygen is incredibly important for shaping the planet as we understand it.
How much of our atmosphere right now is oxygen?
It's 21% right now.
21%. And, you know, I wonder how many people would be surprised by that amount and actually think, well, geez, I thought it was a lot more than that. Where are we observing oxygen in our atmosphere in that 21%?
Well, I mean, it's pretty much evenly distributed throughout the atmosphere. So it's 21% pretty much everywhere.
So, I mean, it's in the air. It's also, you know, is it in the land, you know, where on
okay,
Earth?
I see. No, oh, good question. No, oxygen is 21% in the air, but there are many environments on the Earth. In fact, you don't have to go very, very far into mud. I like to study gooey, sticky, smelly mud that sits on the bottom of the ocean. You only have to go in some of this stuff only a millimeter or two before oxygen is gone. So there are lots and lots and lots of places on the Earth where you don't find any oxygen whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't always that way, though. What did the Earth look like many, many years ago, and how much oxygen was in our atmosphere at that time?
Well, you have to go many, 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 many years. But if you went back, let's say, 3 billion years ago, okay, we throw numbers around like that, like they weren't a big deal. 3 billion years is about two-thirds of the history of the planet back in time. There would have been virtually no oxygen in the atmosphere. And by virtually no oxygen in the atmosphere, I mean less than 100,000 times of what we have in the present atmosphere now. So it was basically an oxygen-free world.
So tell us how it came to be. How was it originally created, and how did the Earth eventually change?
Well, this is a very long story, but I'll try to make it as short as possible. Oxygen ultimately was produced by organisms called cyanobacteria. You could view them as the ancestors to the plants that we're probably more familiar with. So cyanobacteria were the first organisms to produce oxygen on Earth. Curiously enough, when cyanobacteria first evolved and first started to produce oxygen, there was very, very little that accumulated into the atmosphere. And And to understand that, we have to understand a little bit about how oxygen gets into the atmosphere. Of course, you would think that oxygen comes from the production of oxygen by plants and cyanobacteria, and that's absolutely true. But whereas cyanobacteria produce oxygen, lots of other organisms, including cyanobacteria, also consume oxygen again. So there's a balance that's almost perfect between the consumption and production of oxygen. And if that balance is so perfect, then very, very little can get into the atmosphere. So it gets into the atmosphere because some oxygen, or not some oxygen, some of the original cyanobacteria, let's say, get buried away in marine mud, and that stuff becomes oil, for example, or carbon in rocks. And that carbon in rocks that represents just a little bit of oxygen that's been put into the atmosphere. So that started to happen as soon as cyanobacteria evolved. But the problem was is that there were also lots of gases coming out of the Earth, like hydrogen, for example, that consumed what little oxygen cyanobacteria actually produced and liberated to the atmosphere. And way, way, way back in Earth history, this gas liberation was much, much faster than it is now. So try as cyanobacteria would to make as much oxygen as they could, there was very, very little that could, in fact, accumulate in the atmosphere way back then.
Wow. I'm curious how you, as a scientist, have come about figuring that all out. How do you study ancient atmosphere?
Well, it hasn't just been me, I can tell you that. Lots of people have done this. But we get our clues from rocks, mainly. And you know, you pick up a rock, and the kind of rocks we look at are rocks that used to be sediment deposited in the oceans, so marine muds. And you look at some of this stuff, and it may not tell you a whole lot just to look at it, but when you start to chemically analyze the components in the rocks, they start to tell a great deal. There are signals in these rocks, for example, that can tell you whether or not there was oxygen around in the atmosphere, and other signals which begin to tell you a little bit about how much. So if you have a lot of clever people working on this problem and thinking real hard about it, then they're actually able to tease out these chemical signals from the rocks and learn a great deal about the history of the Earth's atmosphere.
Now, a lot of what we discuss in terms of the Earth's history and, you know, even the creation of Earth is often debated in the public sphere. I'm wondering if there's a debate about this at all, either in the public sphere or in your profession.
Oh, sure. I guess it depends on what you think the debate will be. Among scientists, the history of oxygen gets widely debated. I think there's a general consensus that oxygen levels were actually quite low before about 2.4 billion years ago. That seems to be pretty well appreciated now. What is less clear is when cyanobacteria actually first evolved and when they first started to produce oxygen into the atmosphere. And that's actually highly critical because that makes the history much, much richer. I'm of the school that cyanobacteria actually evolved well before this 2.4 billion year time period. So there was this period, as I explained just a few minutes ago, where there was active oxygen production by cyanobacteria, but very, 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 very little in the atmosphere. So there's a great deal of debate about that, and you know, as there is in science, there's a great deal of debate about many, many aspects of the history, and we maybe can come to some of that as we go along in the interview.
Mm. Donald, we're talking with Donald Canfield. He's a professor of ecology at the University of Southern Denmark and director of the Nordic Center for Earth Evolution. His book is Oxygen, A 4 Billion Year History.
And you can give us a call on this at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about oxygen and the world that we live in? You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Donald Canfield about the history and evolution of oxygen on Earth. And you can join our conversation as well. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can also send us an email at talk@WPR.org. Donald, just before the break, you were starting a thought, and I'd like you to pick up where you left off there.
Well, I was just sort of describing what some of the controversies are and related to the history of atmospheric oxygen. I think one of the real big ones, which I think is quite interesting, is the relationship between oxygen and the evolution of animals, which happened about 600 million years ago. And there's some geochemical evidence. That means there's evidence in sediments to suggest that oxygen levels might have risen in the atmosphere at about that time. And that actually becomes really, really interesting, because one of the popular discussions about the late emergence of animals is that animals have a requirement for rather high oxygen levels, and that an increase in oxygen might have actually enabled animals to be able to thrive in the environment. So it's been discussed that this rise in oxygen that we seem to detect at around 600 million years ago might have actually enabled, if not the original evolution of animals, at least the evolution of large animals, which do have rather high oxygen requirements. And I've actually, oddly enough, research on both sides of this fence, because we've contributed some of the evidence for an increase in oxygen at this time, but we've also lately been thinking a little bit harder about it and trying to explore actually what are the oxygen requirements for early evolved animals. And we've been working with sponges, and sponges are believed to be some of the very, very first types of animals that evolved, and we've been looking at the oxygen requirements for sponges, and it's actually astonishingly low. They need very, very little oxygen, indeed, in order to be able to survive. So our idea that an increase in oxygen 600 million years ago might have actually paced the evolution of early animals may in fact be incorrect. That other factors, likely just biological evolutionary factors, might have inhibited or kept animals from evolving until rather late in Earth history.
Wow. Let's take a call first. I'm going to give the phone number one more time. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's talk to Neil in Slinger.
Okay.
Hi, Neil.
Hi. I got a question. The atmospheric oxygen is around 20-some percent. When I go to the doctor and they check my blood oxygen, it's up to around 95%. How do animals and or humans increase that level in the bloodstream?
That's a really good question, and I don't have a really good answer for it. My guess is that what happens is your blood selects the oxygen out of the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is 21% oxygen and then mainly nitrogen after that. And that the hemoglobin in your blood will preferentially select the nitrogen or the oxygen, leaving the nitrogen behind. That would be my guess.
Thanks for that call, Neil. Daniel, or Donald, I'm wondering why oxygen in particular is so important to life on Earth. Why not maybe some of those other noble gases like hydrogen, nitrogen? You know, why did oxygen make it, why was oxygen crucial in the evolution of life on Earth?
Okay, that's actually a really interesting question. You need a compound which is able to react with other compounds in something called an oxidation reduction reaction. Hydrogen can do that, and in fact, hydrogen might have been a very, very important compound driving life early in Earth history before oxygen. But the thing about oxygen is that it's just simply so energetic. It's about the most energetic compound you can have to react, for example, with organic matter. So it gives so much energy, And plus, it's freely available in the atmosphere. It's easy to access, but it just becomes the compound of choice for life.
Take us back 2.3 billion years ago. The Earth hit a tipping point for oxygen. What happened, and how did that event change everything?
Okay, well, here's another one of those things which is widely discussed among the community. But for me, I think the best explanation is that remember I mentioned that there were lots of gases, reducing gases coming out of the mantle, hydrogen being the main culprit, and that was keeping oxygen low. Well, the history of the Earth is actually very, very interesting, and one important aspect, and that is that the Earth has been cooling through its history. It was very much warmer earlier in its history, and as the Earth has been cooling, its mantle, which is the layer of Earth underneath the crust that we live on, has been slowing down in its convection and its circulation. So that means that there's less volcanic activity through time. And volcanic activity is what delivers hydrogen to the atmosphere. So the idea is that about 2.3 billion years ago, the volcanic activity of the Earth decreased to the point where the hydrogen flux decreased to the point that oxygen could begin to accumulate. And I actually like that explanation very much. I think it gives a rational reason for why oxygen would have increased at about that time.
You know, one topic that I think about as I consider your book here is global climate change and carbon dioxide emissions, mm-hmm. and how that's become an issue here for our world today. How do you see oxygen playing a role, I guess, in the continued evolution of our Earth's atmosphere, given that given the increase in carbon dioxide emissions?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. It's been within the last 15 years or so that people have been able to measure the oxygen concentration to enough sensitivity to be able to see the influence of anthropogenic activity on it. And it is fascinating because what you see is an annual cycle of oxygen increasing a little bit due to photosynthesis in the summer and decreasing a little bit due to net respiration in the winter. And you can also see the oxygen levels dropping ever so slightly in response to the burning of fossil fuels. But the reality is that those changes are extremely small, and that global climate change, or let's say the burning of fossil fuels, will have very, very little impact on the levels of atmospheric oxygen over centuries, millennia, I would say. So over thousands of years anyway, the levels of oxygen in the atmosphere are going to be very, very stable.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So we don't have to, what's one thing we don't have to worry about?
Well, that's nice. Yeah. You know, meanwhile, I'm sure I know scientists are grappling with greenhouse gases and global climate change. Is there a way to, in a sense, extract oxygen to, I don't know, offset some of the negative elements of our atmosphere?
Well, I mean, you can easily extract oxygen from the atmosphere, but I'm not sure how that would help.
As
a gas, oxygen isn't one of the greenhouse gases, so it's not something that influences the what's called the radiative balance of the Earth. So I'm not sure that would help anything. Plus, there's so much oxygen in the atmosphere that to be able to change the concentrations would be devastatingly difficult. I mean, if all of the fossil fuels that we've burned over the last hundreds of years have only changed it to minuscule amounts, you know, we'd have a very, very difficult time changing it if we wanted to.
How can research like yours be used by organizations like NASA, who might be searching for planets that could be conducive to life?
Well, that's another really good question. I think that when I sit back and I think about the Earth, I think about what a variety of very, very special events have allowed Earth to be able to accumulate oxygen into its atmosphere. I mean, it required first the evolution of cyanobacteria, which wasn't such a straightforward thing. I mean, cyanobacteria first evolved after a variety of other types of photosynthetic bacteria, first of all, types that don't produce oxygen. So that whole process took some time and some evolutionary development. And then the interesting point that we've been discussing is that even after cyanobacteria evolved and started producing oxygen, then the levels of oxygen remained very, very low for a long period of time until the Earth started to behave to the point where oxygen could first accumulate. So I think that as a vehicle for looking for life, looking for oxygen actually might not be such a good thing to focus on because there are lots of life forms on the Earth and presumably other places, if there is life there, that don't require oxygen. And even after oxygen-producing organisms have evolved on Earth, and let's say, presuming that they might have evolved somewhere else, it's not clear that you'd be able to see the oxygen in the atmosphere. But on the other side, if you were to find a planet that did contain oxygen in appreciable amounts, that would tell you, I think, a lot of very, very important things about both the biology and the physical nature of the planet, which would be extremely exciting.
For something so common as oxygen, it would seem like all the questions that we have about it have been answered. What mysteries are you still trying to solve about oxygen?
Well, there's so much that we really need to understand. I've sort of summarized in this book what I think we understand to now, but you know there are huge parts of the geologic record which are very, very difficult to understand because the record is so spotty. You know, there are hundreds of millions of years of missing time where we need to try to fill in. If you were to ask me what was the level of atmospheric oxygen 1.5 billion years ago, for example, I'd say, well, probably about 10% of what it is now. Well, it might have been 1%, and it might have been 25%, you know, given the ability we have to interpret the signals that we have. So our understanding isn't as constrained as one would like.
Well, Donald, I'm so sorry. You have a lot of interesting points. We're actually out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Donald Canfield is a professor of ecology at the University of Southern Denmark and director of the Nordic Center for Earth Evolution. His new book is Oxygen, A 4 Billion Year History.